Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 185 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be focusing on a gastroenterology review for the USMLE Step 1 exam. I've made an intro podcast in the past, but I'm going to make this my first one, like mainstream one. And then it'll be in a series, and then we'll be done with all of GI. So let's get right into it. So what if you get a question about a 45-year-old guy, and they tell you that this guy has hypercalcemia, and this guy has been having these like severe episodes of like epigastric pain that is not necessarily radiating to the back, and then the MBME asks you, what other finding would you most likely observe on a physical exam, like on further exam and testing? What answer should you go with? Well, I would hope you go with hyperprolactinemia, right? So this person has classic MEN1 syndrome, right? So the thing is, MEN1 syndrome, remember, it's a triad, right? And the way I think about it, it's a triad, like you remember it as para, pan, pit, right? So para, pan, pit, the para stands for parathyroid hyperplasia. So that's the classic presentation of primary hyperparathyroidism in those folks. And then two is these people tend to have pituitary adenomas. The most common one will be a prolactinoma. And then three, these people also tend to have para, pan, pit, pituitary adenomas, and then they can have pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, of which a gastrinoma is the most common, right? So that's the thing that's causing the peptic ulcer disease in this patient, right? Although another thing that could also be causing peptic ulcer disease in this patient is hypercalcemia, because hypercalcemia actually increases the release of gastrin, and that can ultimately cause a production of more gastric acid, right? And that can increase a person's risk of peptic ulcer disease, right? But this person has a gastrinoma. Remember, a gastrinoma literally is a tumor that secretes gastrin, right? And when you secrete gastrin, as I'll talk about shortly, you'll have an increase in your gastric acid secretion, and you'll have things of that nature. So let's, I guess, maybe talk some more about this, right? So how is gastric acid secreted? Well, obviously, gastric acid comes from parietal cells, right? Remember, parietal cells, we find them in the stomach. And those parietal cells, they secrete two high-yield things you want to know for the purposes of the USMLE exams. They secrete, like, hydrogen ions, right, through, like, a hydrogen-potassium antipodder that you find on their surfaces. And the thing is, it's actually very high yield to know that that hydrogen-potassium antipodder is an ATPase. You may say, okay, Divine, why is it an ATPase? Well, it's an ATPase because it uses ATP. And it uses ATP because you're getting potassium into the cell against its concentration gradient. Remember, potassium is primarily an intracellular ion. So the thing is, if you want to bring even more potassiums into the cell, then you're essentially moving them in against their gradient. And if you're moving them in against their gradient, right, you'll need ATP for that. So that antipodder takes potassium into the parietal cell, and then it brings hydrogen ions out. So that's how you get the acidity of the stomach. And then another high yield thing that's secreted by your parietal cells is intrinsic factor. Intrinsic factor is what is used together with vitamin B12 to help you essentially reabsorb vitamin B12 at the level of the terminal ileum. So how do we ultimately release gastric acid? Well, the thing is, it all starts with the vagus nerve. So the vagus nerve actually can release something known as gastrin-releasing peptide, okay? That gastrin-releasing peptide will literally act on G cells that you find in the antrum of the stomach, and then those G cells will make gastrin, right? And then that gastrin, it can do multiple things. One thing it can do is it can talk to your parietal cells directly to go ahead and make acid. Another thing it can do is it can also talk to a certain kind of cell known as the enterochromaffin-like cell. The enterochromaffin-like cell is, in fact, this is actually the main mechanism that gastrin helps with causing acid release in the stomach. So gastrin will bind to receptors on the surfaces of the enterochromaffin-like cells. I'll call them ECL cells going forward. And then those ECL cells will then release histamine. And then that histamine will act on H2 receptors that we'll find on the parietal cells. Remember, those are G-protein coupled receptors. If you want to be a little more specific, they are G-stimulatory, so GS, G-protein coupled receptors. That will increase the activity of adenylate cyclase, and that will cause acid secretion. So it should make sense that if you want to shut down acid secretion, one thing you can actually do is to give a H2 blocker, a H2 histamine receptor blocker, like a drug like famotidine or ranitidine or cimetidine. Remember, cimetidine is an inhibitor of cytochrome P450. So when you inhibit those H2 receptors, then you're essentially inhibiting that ECL cell mediated release of acid. So that's one high yield thing to know. Another high yield thing to sort of keep at the back of your mind with all this acid secretion is that the vagus nerve can also directly stimulate muscarinic M3 receptors that we find on the surface of parietal cells. And if you stimulate those muscarinic M3 receptors, then that can also increase the release of acid in the GI tract. So let's back up here for a second. So what are the key things that cause acid secretion? We said that the vagus nerve can directly stimulate muscarinic M3 receptors on parietal cells. That's one. Second thing we said is that the vagus nerve can release something known as gastrin-releasing peptide, which will act on the G cells that we find in the antrum of the stomach. And then those G cells release gastrin. Now we said that gastrin can directly stimulate parietal cells. That's a smaller mechanism. But the more bigger mechanism is that gastrin can also act on ECL cells, which then in turn release histamine. And then that histamine acts on H2 receptors, and then that promotes the release of acid from parietal cells. This pathway is very high yield to make sure you understand. Now, the thing is, on these parietal cells, we also have receptors that are sensitive to prostaglandins. Okay. The thing is, those receptors, though, are they're also G-protein coupled receptors, but they are inhibitory G-protein coupled receptors. So the thing that happens is, when prostaglandins bind to those GI-based G-protein coupled receptors, that will decrease the amount of adenylate cyclase that pervades the parietal cell, and that will shut down the release of acid, right? So this is one of the reasons why taking an NSAID can cause peptic ulcer disease, because when you take an NSAID, NSAIDs are inhibitors of COX, of cyclooxygenase, and cyclooxygenase is involved in the production of prostaglandins. So if you take an NSAID, you inhibit COX, you'll have less synthesis of prostaglandins. If you have less synthesis of prostaglandins, you'll have less activation of those inhibitory G-protein coupled receptors that you find on the surfaces of parietal cells. And that would cause an increased release of acid, and that can predispose the person to having peptic ulcer disease. So that's the mechanism behind NSAIDs increasing a person's risk of peptic ulcer disease. And if you notice, I said that those are that hydrogen potassium ATPase pump that you find on the luminal surface of a parietal cell, right? I said again, that's the primary transporter that's responsible, not transporter, but primary pump responsible for the production of acid in the stomach. The thing is, you can actually make antibodies against that pump, or you can make antibodies against the parietal cell as a whole, or you can make antibodies against intrinsic factor. And that's the pathophysiology behind pernicious anemia, right? Because think about it, if you knock the parietal cells out of circulation and you no longer make intrinsic factor, then you will not have the marriage partner of vitamin B12 to have the ability to reabsorb B12 at the level of the terminal ileum. That's one high yield thing to know there. Second high yield thing to know there is that we have a class of drugs that actually work by inhibiting that hydrogen potassium antipodder. They are known as the proton pump inhibitors, right? Because literally that hydrogen potassium antipodder is a proton pump. So if you have a drug that inhibits that pump, it should make sense that it's known as a proton pump inhibitor, a PPI. So the thing is, those PPIs, they inhibit that pump, and those drugs all end in prazole. So they are very easy to recognize on exams, right? So drugs like omeprazole, lansoprazole, esomeprazole, pantoprazole, those are all PPIs, and they all work by inhibiting that proton pump that you find on the surface of parietal cells. And then, again, kind of tying back to what I mentioned initially, talking about a person that had MEN1. Remember, MEN1, they can have pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Well, one of the pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors they can have is a gastrinoma. Remember, that's something known as the Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. One classic presentation of the Zollinger-Ellison syndrome on MBME exams is they'll talk about a person that has ulcers, but they'll tell you that this person has ulcers in the jejunum. When a person has peptic ulcer disease, it is extremely unusual to have ulcers that are that distal. So if you see like distal ulcers in the small intestine, aka the jejunum, or like a distal duodenal ulcer, you want to think about Zollinger-Ellison syndrome as a possible etiology. And really, the way you treat a gastrinoma is obviously you want to remove the tumor, but some other measures you can also explore, right? Obviously, is to give a PPI, because ultimately the thing that's causing many of your symptoms, right, is the fact that you have the gastrin coming from the gastrinoma stimulating the parietal cell directly and also stimulating the enterochromaffin-like cell to cause problems. So if you have the ability to inhibit that end gateway, right, of acid secretion in the GI tract, aka the proton pump, then you can fix that person's problems. Another drug you can also give is, you can actually give octreotide. So octreotide, right, it's a somatostatin analog, but the thing it does is that it essentially inhibits the secretion of many things in the GI tract, and it can directly stop the parietal cells from making acid, and it can also directly stop the G cells. So these are all high yield important things to know for the purposes of exams. So again, make sure you can sort of put all these things together. And one other thing I guess I'll mention that's kind of important that many people do not realize is that, remember that many people will think, in fact, this is one common ploy the MBME plays on people. They'll try to get you to think that G cells that make gastrin, because I said, oh, it's the vagus nerve, parasympathetic system that stimulates G cells to secrete gastrin, right? So the MBME will try to trick you into picking acetylcholine as the direct stimulant of G cells to make gastrin. Resist that temptation on your exams. Gastrin secretion from the G cells is promoted very specifically by gastrin-releasing peptide. So it's the vagus nerve that is actually making that gastrin-releasing peptide that is then stimulating those G cells. So again, very high yield, very important to make sure you actually understand what's going on with that. So what are some, I guess, other important things that kind of happen in the stomach, right? So remember that the stomach also has chief cells. Those chief cells, they make a particular zymogen known as pepsinogen, okay? So pepsinogen, right, it's the zymogen form of an enzyme known as pepsin. The thing is that pepsin is the thing that actually helps you start protein digestion. So protein digestion actually starts in the stomach, right? And it happens under the action of pepsin. But the thing is, those chief cells do not make direct pepsin, they make pepsinogen. And then that pepsinogen, when it's exposed to the low pH environment of the stomach, it's then cleaved from the zymogen form to the active form known as pepsin, and then you have protein digestion. And then remember that we also have some cells in the stomach, right? Like sometimes they call them just mucosal cells. Those mucosal cells, they make bicarb. And that bicarb will help you protect the GI the stomach mucosa from erosion, right? Because again, the pH of the stomach is like 2. It's very, very acidic, right? So the thing is, you need bicarb to kind of help you with that process. So that bicarb comes from just certain mucosal cells that directly make bicarb to coat the lining of the stomach, so that again, you don't essentially like denude your stomach and mucosa. And from a histological perspective, it's very high yield to know that your stomach is made of simple columnar epithelium, okay? The thing is, the histology of the GI tract in general is very, very high yield to know for the purposes of the USMLE exams, right? So your stomach has simple columnar epithelium, okay? Your stomach has simple columnar epithelium. So really, for the most part, those are kind of like the big things that are secreted in the stomach. And remember, like I said, if a person has pernicious anemia, you're not making intrinsic factor, you'll get a B12 deficiency. And obviously, a B12 deficiency can cause lots and lots of problems, right? Like people with B12 deficiency, they can get like a peripheral neuropathy, right? And when you have a B12 deficiency, remember, that will also elevate your levels of homocysteine, right? And then if you also have a B12 deficiency, remember, B12 is a cofactor for the enzyme known as methylmalonyl-CoA mutase. So if you have a deficiency of B12, methylmalonyl-CoA mutase will not work. So you'll lose the ability to convert methylmalonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA. So that's why your methylmalonic acidemia is pathognomonic on MBME exams of a B12 deficiency. And then you should also not forget that a B12 deficiency can also cause a megaloblastic anemia. because you're kind of messing up DNA synthesis, right? So if you're not able to make DNA, then you can get into trouble with amyloblastic anemia. And classically, right, on a blood smear, you'll see the classically described hypersegmented neutrophils with that. And then one final thing that a person can also get with a B12 deficiency is that they will get something known as a subacute combined degeneration of the spinal cord. Okay, a subacute combined degeneration of the spinal cord. Basically, your lateral corticospinal tract will be screwed up. So those people will have like upper motor neuron symptoms. And then another thing that will be screwed up is the dorsal columns, right? Your dorsal column medial lemniscus system. So you'll have problems with like fine touch, vibratory sense, and proprioceptive sense. Okay, so again, those are all high yield things to know in relation to vitamin B12. Now, one other thing your friends at the MBME kind of expect you to know with regards to the GI tract, especially since I've kind of talked about the stomach, is just kind of knowing the blood supply. I've probably said this ad nauseum in multiple podcasts, but this is just something that people find as a bear to memorize. To be perfectly honest with you, the easiest way to learn this stuff is just to draw it out. If you draw it out and go over it a couple of times, it will stick in your mind, okay? Draw it out a couple of times, it'll stick in your mind. So the thing is, your GI tract embryologically is divided into three major groups. We have the foregut, we have the midgut, and we have the hindgut. So you may say, oh, Divine, what makes up the foregut? Well, the things that make up the foregut are things like your stomach, your duodenum, right? At least like the first and second parts of the duodenum. Essentially, everything in your duodenum up until the ligament of tridents, or you can see maybe the ampulla of Vater if you want to. Either one, it really doesn't matter. But up until that level, that's your foregut. Your foregut also includes things like your gallbladder, your liver, your spleen, and some like your esophagus for the most part. You can also technically call that foregut. Okay, so that's something that's very high yield to know. And then your midgut is everything from like the rest of your duodenum that does not include your foregut to the proximal two-thirds of the transverse colon. Okay, and then your hindgut is everything from the distal end, basically from the splenic flexure to the upper third of the rectum. That's your hindgut. So why is it important to differentiate things like this? It's important to differentiate things like that because your foregut has a specific blood supply. It's the celiac artery. Your midgut has a specific blood supply. It's the superior mesenteric artery. And your hindgut has a specific blood supply. It's the inferior mesenteric artery. Remember, it's very high yield to know that the inferior mesenteric artery is the blood supply to the hindgut. And remember that your hindgut ends just at the pectinic line. The pectinic line is basically like takes up like the upper third of the rectum. Okay, so the upper third of the rectum, and then like your sigmoid colon, and then your descending colon, and then like your splenic flexure. Those all fall under the purview of the hindgut, and they are all supplied by the inferior mesenteric artery. Basically, your mucosa below the pectinic line is actually serviced from a blood supply perspective by the internal iliac artery. Okay, in fact, the blood drainage for that, like distal to pectinic line, like the lower like parts of your rectum, that's actually goes directly to the IVC, versus like your hindgut, like again, like the part above the pectinic line that actually drains into the portal vein. So that's something you don't want to screw over, right? So again, the celiac artery supplies the foregut. The superior mesenteric artery supplies the midgut, and then the inferior mesenteric artery supplies the hindgut. So let's talk about the celiac artery and kind of like its branches. Those are kind of important to know, right? So the celiac artery, again, it comes off of the thoracic aorta, okay? So it comes off of the thoracic aorta, and then it has three major branches, right? The three major branches, there's one known as the left gastric artery. That's the first major branch. The second branch is known as the splenic artery. And then the third branch is known as the common hepatic artery. Okay, so I'll say that again. Your celiac artery has three branches. It has the splenic artery, the left gastric artery, and the common hepatic artery, right? Now, the thing is, the splenic artery ultimately gives rise to another artery known as the... your splenic artery actually gives rise to the right... No. It gives rise to the left gastroepiploic artery. The left gastroepiploic artery is occasionally known as the left gastroomental artery. You'll see that if there is a left gastroomental artery, you'll see in a few seconds that there is also such a thing known as the right gastroomental artery. The right gastroomental artery actually comes from an artery known as the gastroduodenal artery. But let me back up here for a second. So the big branch of the splenic artery is the left gastroepiploic artery. Now, the left gastric artery doesn't really have any significant branches beyond, let's just say left gastric artery is one branch of the celiac artery and leave it like that. Now, the thing is, the common hepatic artery actually has three branches, right? One branch is what's known as the right gastric artery, okay? So that right gastric artery, anastomosis with the left gastric artery, which is a branch of the actual celiac artery. So celiac artery gives off the left gastric artery, and then the common hepatic artery, which is one of the main branches of the celiac artery, gives off the right gastric artery, that anastomosis with that left gastric artery. And the anastomosis is actually along the lesser curvature of the stomach, okay? Now, so I've said the common hepatic artery gives off three major branches. One major branch is the right gastric artery, again, that anastomosis with the left gastric artery, which is a branch of the celiac. The second major branch of the common hepatic artery is the hepatic artery proper, okay? And the hepatic artery proper divides further to form the right hepatic artery and the left hepatic artery, okay? So let's trace it down again. Celiac artery gives rise to the common hepatic artery. The common hepatic artery gives rise to the right gastric artery. It gives rise to the hepatic artery proper, and that hepatic artery proper gives rise to the right gastric artery, to the right hepatic artery and the left hepatic artery. It so happens that the right hepatic artery gives off the cystic artery. The cystic artery is the blood supply to the gallbladder, right? So again, two big branches I've talked about with the common hepatic artery. Hepatic artery proper, that gives off the right and left hepatic arteries, and then the right gastric artery, that anastomosis with the left gastric artery, which is a branch of the celiac artery. Now, the third major branch of the common hepatic artery is an artery known as the gastroduodenal artery, okay? The gastroduodenal artery. So what is the high yield thing you want to know about the gastroduodenal artery? Well, you want to recognize that the gastroduodenal artery gives rise to two very high yield arteries that you want to keep at the back of your mind for the USMLEs. So the gastroduodenal artery, or the GDA, okay, gives rise to the right gastroepiploic artery, which you can also call the right gastroomental artery, okay? So that right gastroomental artery, anastomosis with the left gastroomental artery, which is a branch of the splenic artery, okay? And that anastomosis is also actually along the greater curvature of the stomach. So right gastroomental artery from the splenic artery, anastomosis with the left gastroomental artery from the gastroduodenal artery, okay, along the greater curvature of the stomach. Basically, that's the blood supply for the greater curvature of the stomach, okay? So right gastroomental artery is one branch of the gastroduodenal artery, and then the second branch of the gastroduodenal artery is the anterior superior pancreaticoduodenal artery. I'll say that again. It's the anterior superior pancreaticoduodenal artery. The anterior superior pancreaticoduodenal artery supplies, as the term goes, it supplies a part of the duodenum, and it also supplies a part of the pancreas. It so happens that there is actually such a thing as the inferior posterior pancreas, or sometimes some people call it anterior inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery. That comes from the superior mesenteric artery, right? So that's the key region of anastomosis. So let me kind of summarize three key anastomoses that I've mentioned, because again, these anastomoses end up being very, very high yield for the USMLE Step 1 exam. We have an anastomosis along the lesser curvature of the stomach. That's an anastomosis of the left gastric artery, which is a branch of the celiac artery, and the right gastric artery, which is a branch of the common hepatic artery, which is a branch of the celiac artery. And then along the greater curvature of the stomach, we have an anastomosis between the right gastroomental artery, which is a branch of the gastroduodenal artery, which is a branch of the common hepatic artery, which is a branch of the celiac artery. And then that right gastroomental artery anastomosis with the left gastroomental artery, which is a branch of the splenic artery. And remember that the splenic artery is a branch of the celiac artery. And then the third anastomosis is the anterior superior pancreaticoduodenal artery, which is a branch of the gastroduodenal artery, which is a branch of the common hepatic artery, which is a branch of the celiac artery. And again, remember the anterior superior pancreaticoduodenal artery, anastomosis with the anterior inferior. Sometimes you see people say posterior inferior. It doesn't matter. Just find the words inferior and you're good to go. So I will just use anterior inferior. Let me kind of keep my A straight. So the anterior inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery is a branch of the superior mesenteric artery. So that's an region of anastomosis between the SMA and the celiac artery. Again, very, very high yield to know those things for the purposes of the USMLE Step 1 exam. And then, since I guess I've kind of talked about the stomach, let me go a little higher and talk about the esophagus, right? So What are some key high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with the esophagus? Well, some key high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with the esophagus is that the esophagus, right, is, you can divide it up in thirds, right? So there's the upper third, middle third, and the lower third. The upper third of the esophagus is made up of purely skeletal muscle. The lower third is made up of purely smooth muscle. And then the middle third is a mixture of skeletal and smooth muscle. Okay, so that's a nice way to remember that. So upper third, skeletal muscle, lower third, smooth muscle, middle third, skeletal and smooth muscle. Now, the thing is, the esophagus has an upper esophageal sphincter at the top, and then at the bottom, it has a lower esophageal sphincter. The thing is, that lower esophageal sphincter relaxes when food is about to make its way from the esophagus to the stomach. Okay, and the thing is, the problem is, you can actually have some issues there where, let's say, for example, you don't have like Auerbach's plexus. Remember, another name for Auerbach's plexus is the myenteric plexus. If you lack Auerbach's plexus, also known as the myenteric plexus, then your lower esophageal sphincter will not be able to relax. And if it's not able to relax, that's something known as achalasia. Okay, that's something known as achalasia. And achalasia, classically, if they ask for the diagnostic step you want to pursue on your exam, at least for the purposes of the USMLE Step 1 exam, you can do a barium swallow, okay? You do that barium swallow and you'll see the classically described bird's beak sign. And really, the way you treat achalasia is, I mean, there are many things you can do. You can do what is this thing called? You can do like a pneumatic dilation of the esophagus, although very few people do that because that has a very high risk of esophageal perforation. Another thing you can do is you can also do like an esophageal myectomy. I think some people call it like a Ramstedt. I think that's like a German name, like a Ramstedt myectomy. And you use that to get rid of the, excise some muscle. And that will, you know, again, relax that lower esophageal sphincter. Okay. Now, some other things you want to keep at the back of your mind with achalasia. And this is one thing that many resources, for whatever reason, do not cover, right? But it's very, very high yield to know for the USMLE exams. The thing is, the esophagus, right? When a person has achalasia, their lower esophageal sphincter fails to relax. So the lower esophageal sphincter tone is increased. That's one. But another thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is people that have achalasia also have problems with esophageal motility. The esophageal motility is not right in achalasia. That's something very high yield to know. Another thing that's also very high yield to know is that when a person has achalasia, they tend to, you may say, oh, what are some things that can cause it? Well, sometimes when people have achalasia, we don't know the cause. But one other thing that can actually cause achalasia is if a person has Chagas disease, okay? Remember, Chagas disease is caused by a bug known as Trypanosoma cruzii, okay? Trypanosoma cruzii causes a lot of big problems. I've said this ad nauseum in many podcasts, right? So it can cause achalasia, aka dilated esophagus. It can cause a dilated cardiomyopathy, right? And then another thing you may also observe with that is it can also cause a dilated bowel, right? It can cause something known as Hirschsprung's disease. So those are three high-yield pathologies you want to be able to associate with Trypanosoma cruzii on MBM exams. Dilated GI tract, like dilated bowel, right? Hirschsprung's disease, dilated esophagus, achalasia, and then dilated heart, dilated cardiomyopathy from T. cruzii, okay? So those are all high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then remember that if a person has scleroderma, right? In fact, there's a kind of scleroderma known as CREST scleroderma. You may say, oh, Divine, what does CREST stand for? Well, CREST, right? The C is for calcinosis, right? The R is for Raynaud phenomenon. Raynaud phenomenon is actually the most common presentation of CREST scleroderma. And then the E is for esophageal dysmotility, right? So people that have CREST scleroderma, they can have like really bad GERD because they just have issues with, they just kind of like fibrose the lower esophageal sphincter. So it's like open pathway for acid to come from the stomach up to the esophagus. So that's why those people can have those problems. And then the S stands for sclerodactyly. It's like a fingernail finding. And then the T is for telangiectasias. And it's actually very important for the USMLE exams to remember that CREST scleroderma is associated with anti-centromere antibodies, okay? Anti-centromere antibodies associated with CREST scleroderma. So that's one high-yield thing to know there. And then some other high-yield things to know with the esophagus, right? So let me give you a question about a person, and let me show you some labs, and let me tell you that, oh, this person has trouble swallowing. And then they may show you like the person's tongue, and you may see that the person's tongue looks very smooth. And then they may give you labs that show the person's hemoglobin to be 8 with an MCV of like 67. If you notice, right, low hemoglobin, obviously the person has an anemia. And if you notice with the MCV of 67, that's a microcytic anemia. So it's likely like some kind of like iron deficiency anemia. If you see iron deficiency anemia in the context of a person having trouble swallowing, so dysphagia, and then they tell you that this person, you know, again, has like that smooth tongue, then you want to think about something known as Plummer-Vinson syndrome. Okay, Plummer-Vinson syndrome is a triad of iron deficiency anemia, and then they have esophageal webs that can cause dysphagia, and then they can also have glossitis. Okay, those are all high yield things to know. And then if they give you a question about like an alcoholic, let's see a person that, you know, drinks like a pint of vodka every day and has drank this pint of vodka for like 40 years. And then they tell you that, oh, this person presents with like severe hematemesis and the person is like profoundly volume depleted, very low blood pressure and everything. Then you want to think about like a bleeding esophageal varices. Remember, esophageal varices arise from a person having a lot of portal hypertension. So when you have portal hypertension, that will cause like distended veins in the esophagus. And if those pressures build up enough, those veins can rupture. And if those veins rupture, you have a very big problem on your hands, right? You can have bleeding varices. And typically those people, many of them die relatively quickly. But if you ask for treatment on your exam, you want to go ahead and perform some kind of endoscopic therapy. And that endoscopic therapy can be one of many things, right? You can do like banding of the varix. Another thing you can do is you can actually give, you can also do like sclerotherapy, but most people do banding of the varix, right? So you do a banding of the varix, you can do sclerotherapy. Another thing you can do is something called a TIPS procedure. So if you see, what does TIPS stand for? Well, TIPS stands for transhepatic, I think it's like transhepatic intra-something portal systemic shunt. Basically, it's a shunt between the portal vein and the hepatic vein, right? So you basically bypass the liver so that you can reduce portal pressures. The only problem is when you bypass the liver, you're bypassing the urea cycle. So those people have a very high risk of hyperammonemia. And remember that hyperammonemia can cause a lot of neurological problems, okay? But that's almost like a last-ditch procedure that you do when a person is not, it's usually done by like interventional radiology. It's like a last-ditch procedure you can do when a person is just not doing very well from an esophageal varices perspective. And then in terms of pharmacological therapy for esophageal varices, you can typically give those people like IV octreotide. In fact, IV octreotide is probably like the drug of choice you can use in the acute phase of esophageal varices. It will cause like splanchnic vasoconstriction, and that will decrease portal pressure, so that can help. But after that acute phase, after the acute phase, chronically, one thing you can do for esophageal varices to chronically lower portal pressures, obviously tell the patient to stop drinking. But other things you can do is you can actually give them like a non-selective beta blocker, like propranolol or nidolol. That will also decrease portal pressures. Another thing you can also do is you can also give them spironolactone. Spironolactone, remember, it's an aldosterone receptor antagonist that also has the ability to block androgen receptors. That's why it can cause gynecomastia as a side effect. But the thing is, spironolactone also decreases portal pressures by, again, some unknown mechanism. But those are two big things you want to know. And then I guess if they really wanted to mess with your head on MBME exams, people that have like bleeding esophageal varices, you should also put them on like a fluoroquinolone prophylactically. It's been shown to actually like have some benefits in that population of people that have elevated portal pressures giving rise to esophageal varices. And then if they give you a question about a person that vomits significantly, and then they start telling you that, oh, this person becomes like very febrile and becomes very hypotensive, and then they tell you that you have like a Rice Krispie sensation on the skin, if you see that presentation on an MBME exam, or they may tell you that, oh, you see like you get an image and they tell you that, oh, on that image they notice like air tracking along the walls of the aorta or along the walls of the airway, that's something known as pneumomediastinum. If you see that, you want to think about Berhaf syndrome, okay? And remember the B in Berhaf for the B in bad. PrEP syndrome is awful, 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 right? The mortality is very, very high. I think it's about, it's probably close to 50% or even more, if I'm not mistaken, right? So the thing is, if you vomit significantly, that sudden increase in esophageal pressures can rupture the esophagus, and then you will essentially have a direct communication between the outside world and the esophagus, right? And the thing is, your friends at the NBME, if they ask you to pick a diagnostic test for PrEP syndrome, they will try to trick you into picking barium swallow as an answer choice. Do not pick barium swallow. The thing is, if you pick barium swallow, barium can cause a very powerful mediastinitis. So you don't want to use it when you suspect that a person has PrEP syndrome. The thing you pick is something called gastrographin. Okay, you do a gastrographin enema. Sometimes instead of putting the word gastrographin enema, they may put like a close term known as a water soluble contrast enema. Okay, it's the same thing. Okay, you can use those to diagnose an esophageal perforation. And obviously those people, you need to wheel them to surgery like yesterday, right? It's a surgical problem. It's something that has to be fixed with surgery. Although again, like I said, the mortality is very high. And then a close cousin to PrEP syndrome is something known as the Mallory-Weiss tear, right? So remember, basically, it's just a person just kind of like lacerating their GE junctions. When you lacerate the GE junctions, those people have like painful hematemesis, but it's usually like a very small volume hematemesis. So it's not life-threatening. You don't really need to treat. You just, you know, the patient will get better with supportive care for the most part, okay? So Mallory-Weiss tear, you don't usually need to do anything significant for it. But PrEP syndrome, you certainly need to take those patients to, you certainly need to take those patients to surgery, right? And then, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has lost like 20 pounds over the last month, and then they tell you that this patient has been having like dysphagia to solids, right? And let's say this person has been like, you know, they've had like a 20-year history of GERD. If you see that, what are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about like esophageal cancer, right? I hope you're thinking, in fact, more along the lines of esophageal adenocarcinoma, right? Because remember, if a person has a long history of prolonged GERD, well, with GERD, you can, you're essentially exposing your esophagus, because normally your esophagus is lined by non-keratinized stratified squamous epithelium. So the thing is, if you expose your esophagus to a chronic acid load, well, your esophagus will be like, oh crap, you know what? Let me try to figure out a way to deal with this problem, right? So it will say, you know what? Since I'm facing a different kind of stress than what I'm used to, I'm going to undergo metaplasia into a type of cell that is better able to handle that acid stress. And that better type of cell is simple columnar epithelium with goblet cells. Sometimes you may see it on MBME exams referred to as an intestinal metaplasia. Okay, so when you undergo that intestinal metaplasia, you form simple columnar epithelium with goblet cells. That will increase your risk ultimately of developing an adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. Okay, in fact, the most common cancer of the esophagus in the United States is an esophageal adenocarcinoma. Okay, but if you're looking more worldwide, the most common esophageal cancer worldwide is esophageal squamous cell cancer. Because again, I said that the native esophagus has non-keratinized stratified squamous epithelium. Okay, but when you undergo that metaplasia, you then have simple columnar epithelium with goblet cells, aka intestinal metaplasia. And the thing that happens is, you know, you when you undergo that intestinal metaplasia, you form something known as Barrett's esophagus. And then Barrett's esophagus, if you have further dysplasia, that can ultimately lead to esophageal adenocarcinoma. And I mean, esophageal adenocarcinoma has an awful, awful, awful prognosis. Now, what are some other key things you want to keep in mind with esophageal adenocarcinoma? The thing is, the NBME may give you a question and say, oh, what is the biggest risk factor for esophageal adenocarcinoma? And they can give you like option A, GERD. They can give you option B, Barrett's esophagus. Resist the temptation to pick GERD. Pick Barrett's esophagus as the biggest risk factor for esophageal adenocarcinoma. Because think about it, between those two answers, because you're, if you think about it, GERD does increase your risk for Barrett's. But the answer choice that has the closest, like the most direct relationship to esophageal adenocarcinoma is Barrett's esophagus. Okay, so on MBME exams, one very good test taking strategy is just to pick the answer choice that is most directly related to the diagnosis that you have made in your Q-STEM. And as a rule, because many people are like, oh Divine, how do I remember what risk factor is what for the esophageal cancers? Let me just give you a simple rule. Barrett's esophagus increases your risk of esophageal adenocarcinoma. Every other esophageal pathology that increases your risk of esophageal cancer will increase your risk of esophageal squamous cell cancer. Okay, will increase your risk of esophageal squamous cell cancer, right? So if, for example, a person consumes lye, or a person consumes like Drano, or a person has achalasia, or a person has some like Plummer-Vinson syndrome, those things all increase risk of esophageal squamous cell cancer. Now, one of the high yield, I guess, series of pathologies you may see with the esophagus on the USMLE exam says, let me give you a question about like a 65-year-old guy, you know, they tell you that his wife is complaining that his breath smells really bad in the mornings. And then they may tell you in the question that, oh, occasionally in the morning, he notices that he regurgitates undigested food. And then they ask for your diagnosis. Well, if they ask for your diagnosis, you should be thinking about Zenker's diverticulum, okay? Zenker's diverticulum. Remember, Zenker's diverticulum is one of those diverticula that you find in the upper third of the esophagus. There are actually other kinds of diverticula that you find in the esophagus. Like in the middle third of the esophagus, there's something known as a traction diverticulum that you find. And then in the distal third of the esophagus, just above the gastroesophageal junction, you have something called an epiphrenic, right? Epiphrenic above the phrenic. Remember, the phrenic nerve supplies the diaphragm, right? So like right above the diaphragm, you have epiphrenic diverticula, right? So the way I remember, like, oh, you're like, oh, Divine, how do I remember which is which? Like Zenker's in the upper third, traction in the middle third, epiphrenic in the lower third. The way to remember this is just remember the company that makes phones like ZTE, right? I mean, I've had a ZTE. It was one of maybe the earliest phones I had when I moved to this country. But ZTE, so Z for Zenker's, upper third, T for traction, middle third, E for epiphrenic, lower third, okay? And one key thing to realize is that Zenker's diverticulum is a false diverticulum. The thing is, the thing that helps you delineate a diverticulum as being a true diverticulum or a false diverticulum is if it includes all the layers of the GI tract, right? So if a diverticulum includes like mucosa, submucosa, muscularis propria, then that tells, and like serosa at the bottom, then that tells you that it's a true diverticulum. A traction diverticulum is an example of a true diverticulum. Zenker's diverticulum is an example of a false diverticulum. It just includes the mucosa and the submucosa. It does not include the muscularis, okay? And remember that Zenker's diverticulum arises because you have weakness as a part of the esophagus known as a Killen's triangle. Killen's triangle, you have that weakness because you may have like atrophy or like the denudement of the cricopharyngeal muscles. So if you have weakness of like your cricopharyngeal muscles, that can ultimately lead to the person having a Zenker's diverticulum. And when a person has a Zenker's diverticulum, you can actually make the diagnosis by doing a barium swallow. Okay, you'll see like the outpouching in the upper third of the esophagus, and then that tells you that, oh, this person has a Zenker's. And one very high yield thing to know in terms of, actually two very high yield things to know with regards to Zenker's. One is treatment. You can treat Zenker's diverticulum by doing something called a diverticulectomy, okay? You just excise the diverticulum. Now, one thing that is contraindicated in a person that has Zenker's diverticulum is to perform an EGD. What does EGD stand for? EGD is an esophagogastroduodenoscopy. Basically, it's something that's done by GI doctors all the time. I mean, look at the term, esophagogastroduodenoscopy. It's basically like a scope, like a microscope that you can use to look at the esophagus. You can use to look at the stomach. That's why there's gastro in the name. And then you can use to look at the duodenum, okay? That's why it's called esophagogastroduodenoscopy, okay? So those are all high-yield things to know there. And EGD is contraindicated in people with Zenker's because if you do an EGD, you can perforate the person's esophagus and then you have essentially almost like Burr-Harve physiology there. Now, one of the high yield things to know with the esophagus that you can get on your exam is, let me give you a question about a patient, you know, that has like, you know, like a CD4 count of 40. And then they tell you that this person has been having odynophagia for the past like 2 weeks. And then they may tell you that, oh, on physical exam, the person has like white membranes on the tongue, right? If you see that, then hopefully you should be thinking about candidal esophagitis, right? Candidal esophagitis. Remember, people that have that are immunocompromised, like HIV patients, they can have esophagitis. And they can have esophagitis from one of three causes. They can have esophagitis from candida, right? They can have esophagitis from CMV, and they can have esophagitis from HSV. Although, if the probably the most common answer you may see on your MBM exam is candida. So if they give you like a non-specific question and they don't give you any clues like, oh, the person has thrush on the mouth or whatever, pick candida. Candida is the most common cause of esophagitis in patients that have HIV, right? And how do you treat candida esophagitis? Candida esophagitis, right? You do like the nystatin swish and swallow, or you can do like a clotrimazole or Zengis that can help you with that. And then if a person has like HSV esophagitis, right, obviously you use acyclovir for that. If the person has esophagitis that's resistant to acyclovir, then you can consider giving foscarnet. Remember, foscarnet is a pyrophosphate analog. And then if a person has CMV esophagitis, you can treat that with ganciclovir, right? Remember, ganciclovir covers CMV really well. If you don't see ganciclovir as an answer choice, you can go with foscarnet. Okay. In fact, if a person has like CMV that is resistant to ganciclovir, remember the resistance arises from mutations in a kinase known as the UL97 kinase, then you can consider giving those people a foscarnet, and that should work. There is very little, if any, resistance to foscarnet by HSV and CMV. So those are the big things you want to keep at the back of your mind with esophagitis. Now, one thing occasionally that your friends at the MBME may do, you know, try to mess with your head with regards to esophagitis, is they may tell you that they may want you to pick the findings you will see on like biopsy or histology. Remember, if a person has candida esophagitis, you will find hyphae on a biopsy specimen, right? On histology. If a person has CMV, they will tell you that, oh, this person has intranuclear inclusions. They'll tell you that, oh, this person has like cells that are enlarged, and you have like intranuclear inclusions, and you have like a halo, like a perinuclear halo. If you see that, think about CMV, okay? HSV also involves intranuclear inclusions, but the thing is, HSV does not have that perinuclear halo. People that have like the intranuclear inclusions in HSV push like the chromatin in the nucleus to the side. Okay, so you don't have that perinuclear halo in a person that has HSV esophagitis. Contrast that with CMV esophagitis, where again, you'll find the intranuclear inclusions, but you have the perinuclear halo. Again, very high yield to know those things for purposes of the MBME exams. And then, remember earlier I said that if you consume lye, that increases your risk of esophageal squamous cell cancer. And I said that esophageal squamous cell cancer is the most common cancer that you find in like worldwide. It's the most common esophageal cancer worldwide, but in the US, again, because the US has a high burden of obesity, so the most common esophageal cancer in the US is esophageal adenocarcinoma. It's actually high yield to know that if they, for example, they give you a question about a person that, you know, consumes like lye or drain cleaner, and then they tell you that, oh, this person is having like a few weeks later or a few days later, this person is having like dysphagia, you want to think about strictures being the cause of the person's dysphagia. Okay, strictures, right? You can essentially have all these adhesions, like all these like linear fibrous bands that form in the esophagus that can cause dysphagia. Now, another thing that can cause strictures in the esophagus is if a person has just prolonged GERD and it's not treated. The thing is, GERD, as you burn away your esophagus with all that acid, that can also lead to the formation of strictures, especially like in the distal esophagus. And if you form those strictures, that can also cause dysphagia. So if you see a person that has a history of GERD having dysphagia, I would really encourage you to think about strictures being the etiology under those circumstances. And then let me try to keep this podcast under an hour. I think let me talk about like a few quick pathologies. Yeah, let me talk about a few quick pathologies here. Let me see, is there any other thing I want to say about the esophagus? Well, I'll see. Maybe one thing I should say about the esophagus is the esophagus doesn't have a serosa. Remember I said for the GI tract, right? You have like your three big layers. You have your mucosa, you have your submucosa, and then you have your muscularis externa. The thing is, and then usually for most other parts of the GI tract, you have a serosa. Not so for the esophagus. The esophagus does not have a serosa. So because the esophagus lacks a serosa, it is actually very easy for esophageal cancer to metastasize to other contents of the mediastinum. And then remember that the esophagus traverses the diaphragm at the at the T10 level, remember, right, there's this classic mnemonic, I ate 10 eggs at 12, to help you remember that the IVC, the inferior vena cava, traverses the diaphragm at the T8 level, right? The esophagus traverses the diaphragm at the T10 level. So I ate 10 eggs, so 10 T10 eggs, esophagus, okay? And then at the T12 level, you have the thoracic aorta. That's where it traverses the diaphragm. You may see, how can things traverse the diaphragm at different thoracic levels? Well, remember, the diaphragm is not a straight structure. It's a dome-shaped structure, right? So there are certain parts that are lower or higher than the others. So those are all high-yield things to keep at the back of your mind on exams. So, what else do I want to say? Okay, let me say a few last things and then maybe teach for like 5 more minutes and then I'll round up this podcast. I just want to keep them under an hour so that it's not like excessive for a person to listen to and understand. But basically, the thing I want to say is let's kind of, I guess, talk about some of the glands that you find, right? So in the tongue, right, we have the parotid gland, we have the sublingual glands, and then we have the submandibular glands, right? So we have the parotid, sublingual, and the submandibular glands. The thing is, the parotid gland, for the most part, makes like serous secretions, like watery secretions. But your sublingual and your submandibular glands, those tend to make more like mixed secretions. So secretions that are both watery and so they are both watery and like mucousy as well, right? So they are like thick. And these things obviously help you make saliva. And saliva is important, right? Because saliva contains like alpha amylase, right? And that alpha amylase actually helps you with beginning the digestion of carbohydrates, right? So carbohydrate digestion actually starts in the mouth under the action of alpha amylase, okay? That's very high yield to know for exams. And remember that saliva, right, also contains, you know, like other things like defensins and lysozymes that can also have like some antibacterial function. And one thing your friends at the NBME may do on an exam is to ask you about the immunoglobulin that you may find in saliva. IgA is the primary immunoglobulin that is found in saliva. And then remember, right, there are certain things you want to keep in mind with regards to like these glands, right? There are certain cancers that can arise in these glands, right? So like, for example, a person can have something called like a pleomorphic adenoma. A pleomorphic adenoma is actually a benign tumor. It's actually the most common benign salivary gland tumor. Usually it arises in the parotid glands, as against like the sublingual or the submandibular glands. Usually it arises in the parotid glands. And I mean, look at the name, pleomorphic, right? So when something is pleomorphic, it means it almost like takes different shapes, right? There are different things in it, right? So the different things in a pleomorphic adenoma is just you having like there, you have like epithelium, but you also have like almost like some stem cells. Sometimes people call them like mesenchymal cells, okay? So you tend to find those in pleomorphic adenomas. It's benign. The thing is, because it's in the parotid gland, remember that your cranial nerve 7, your facial nerve, it does not innervate. It cuts through the parotid gland. Remember, the parotid gland, if I'm not mistaken, is innervated primarily by the glossopharyngeal nerve, cranial nerve 9. So, but check me on that factoid. But I'm fairly certain that's the case. But the facial nerve, right? You remember, before it gives off its terminal branches, you know, it sort of cuts through the parotid gland. So the thing is, when a person has a pleomorphic adenoma, that can actually cause Bell's palsy. Okay, that can cause Bell's palsy, or it can cause like facial nerve palsy, because basically, if the benign tumor grows enough, it can compress the facial nerve, right? So again, that's something high yield to know for exams. And then one other tumor you may find on MBMEs is something called a mucoepidermoid carcinoma. This is actually the second most common overall salivary gland tumor, but it's actually the most common malignant. So remember the M in mucoepidermoid for the M in malignant, okay? It's the most common malignant salivary gland tumor, the mucoepidermoid carcinoma, okay? It has like not so bad of a prognosis, but obviously it doesn't have as good of a prognosis as a pleomorphic adenoma. And then you also see something referred to as like a Worthing's tumor. Worthing's tumor is just a benign salivary gland tumor. Is the probably like the second most common benign salivary gland tumor behind a pleomorphic adenoma. It kind of looks like a germinal center. It's almost like a lymph node in a sense. And one epidemiological factoid you want to know for purposes of the USMLE exams is that most times when a person has a tumor in one of any of the salivary glands, if you see a tumor in the sublingual gland, the chance of that tumor being malignant is very, very high, right? But if you see a tumor grow in the parotid gland, the chance of that tumor being malignant is very, very low. So basically, if you're, and then your submandibular glands are kind of like in between, right? But basically, let me summarize. If you see a tumor in the sublingual gland, it's likely malignant. If you see a tumor in the parotid gland, it's likely benign. And then the submandibular gland is kind of a mixture between the two. So those are, again, all big things to remember. And then remember that people that have Sjogren's syndrome, right, they can have like dry mouth. Because Sjogren's, right, it's like an autoimmune disease of exocrine glands. So those people can have problems producing like saliva, right? So they'll have like, they can have like dental caries. They can have like poor dental hygiene because, again, they're not making those salivary contents that can help you kill bacteria that you find in the mouth. Okay, so those are, again, all big things to keep in mind. So Sjogren's, I remember Sjogren's has an association with anti-RO and anti-LA antibodies, right? Remember, anti-RO are the anti-SSA antibodies, and then anti-LA are the anti-SSB antibodies. And it's actually very high yield to know for purposes of the USMLE exams that those antibodies can cross the placenta and damage the conducting system in the fetus and cause like a third degree heart block, like a complete heart block in the fetus. And then, since I'm talking about saliva, let me just real quick talk about the tongue. The tongue, your friends at the MBME love you to know about the tongue in the context of like the cranial nerves, right? So remember, the tongue, you can divide it by the anterior two thirds and then the posterior one third. The anterior two thirds of the tongue, right? You want to know the cranial nerves that control taste sensation, right? So the general taste sensation, right? So what do I mean by general taste sensation? I mean things like, oh, are you able to feel like pinprick, pain and all that stuff in the anterior two thirds of the tongue? That's controlled by the third branch of the trigeminal nerve, the mandibular nerve, okay, cranial nerve V3. But the special sensation of taste is controlled primarily by cranial nerve 7, your facial nerve, for the anterior two thirds of the tongue. For the posterior third of the tongue, it's your glossopharyngeal nerve that controls both the general sensation of taste and the special sensation of taste. Although in the very back of the tongue, you have like the vagus nerve controlling some of that function. So again, those are high yield things to know. And then the motor activity of the tongue is controlled by the hypoglossal nerve, cranial nerve 12. Remember, all the intrinsic muscles of the tongue are supplied by the hypoglossal nerve, cranial nerve 12, with one exception. The one exception is palatoglossus. Palatoglossus, if you remember Stern's laws that I've talked about in one of my prior podcasts, palatoglossus is actually innervated by the vagus nerve, cranial nerve 10. And whenever a person has hypoglossal nerve injury, remember, the tongue will deviate towards the side of the lesion, right? A very nice way to remember that is like a person like licking their wounds, okay? Like a person licking their wounds. And then remember that occasionally, right, the person may have stones that can obstruct their, like, their salivary gland ducts, okay? They can have stones that obstruct their salivary gland ducts. That's something called like sialolithiasis. Remember, like, lithiasis means stone, right? So sialolithiasis is when you have like, again, a stone obstructing like your salivary gland ducts. The thing is, that can cause severe pain, and behind that obstructing stone, like, infection can build up, and then you can have something called sialadenitis, okay? Like, it's an inflammation of your salivary gland ducts, right? It's most commonly caused by like Staph aureus. Also, strep viridans can also cause a sialadenitis. Some big things that can increase your risk of having those are like, again, having like Sjogren's syndrome, right? So Sjogren's syndrome, if you're also like just chronically dehydrated, that can increase your risk of SDN. Just, if you see me say SDN, I mean sialadenitis. It's just a hard word to pronounce. So risk factors for SDN are things like having Sjogren's syndrome, right? Or being like dehydrated, or having like having undergone intubation, okay? Those things all increase your risk for SDN, okay? All increase your risk for SDN. And also, mumps can also cause that. Remember, mumps can cause like a parotiditis, right? Although mumps usually causes like parotiditis and orchitis, right? Like really large, huge, bigger testicles. And then Again, I said, again, Sjogren's, right? Sjogren's like causes dry mouth because, again, you're causing destruction of your salivary glands. Remember, that dry mouth, the $5 word for that is something known as xerostomia, okay? Xerostomia. And the thing is, when a person has like dry mouth, or a person has like a stone obstructing their salivary gland ducts, one thing you can actually do is you can actually give them like gum or like sour candy. And as they chew on that gum, chew on that sour candy, that will increase the production of saliva, and that can flush that stone through those ducts. So again, kind of big things to know for exams. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. One last thing I want to sneak in. When a person has, basically, your salivary glands are innervated both by your sympathetic and parasympathetic system. Your parasympathetic system tends to cause more for watery secretion, right? Because watery secretion is better for digestion, right? But your sympathetic nervous system tends to make more of a thick secretion. That's why if you're like nervous or anything like that, right? You feel like you see people that are giving talks, they drink a ton of water because they're nervous. So they have like thick salivary gland secretions, right? So they're drinking all this water to try to kind of like moisten up their mouths are better. So let me go ahead and stop here. There are some more things I want to talk about. I'll talk about them in the next podcast. And as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? So step one, step two CK, step two CS, step three. I also tutor for like preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. And then I do this thing called longitudinal tutoring, where if you're a first, second, or third year medical student, I'll tutor you for like your block exams in med school or your shelf exams. But at the same time, I'll also tutor you for your upcoming USMLE exam. Again, people have done this with, they've been like wildly successful. And then I have these things that I call repair courses, where this is more for people that are like in their dedicated periods. If you have like a specific subject weakness, like cardiology is your weakness, like you take a practice exam and your cardiology bar is off to the left or whatever, I can do a repair course. It usually goes for like 2 hours or 2.5 hours at the most, where we just go over in a Q&A format. We just go over like most, if not all, of the high yield stuff you can see tested on that subject for that giving USMLE exam. And most people have done that with, again, that has very effectively erased those errors. And then I also offer like these booster courses. I call them booster courses for the USMLE exams. It's like 20 hours for step one, it's 10 hours for step two, CK, and step three. Where again, if you feel like, you know, you're at the end of your dedicated period, or you want to kind of like put everything together really quickly in a short frame of time, I offer those courses for those exams. And then I also offer like just like comprehensive USMLE courses when I need a group of 5 people. So if you have a group of 5 and you have a location, just let me know. Basically, send me an email if you have a group of 5 people, and we can kind of arrange like location and the timing and everything. I should probably not be talking about specifics on this podcast. Just either like reach out to me through the website or send me an email at divineinterventionpodcast@gmail.com, and then I'll give you some more details. And then finally, if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, I do offer like coaching for those things. So like rec letters, personal statements, application editing, mock interviews, I do all those things. And again, the vast majority of people I've worked with, they've all matched at their first choice. And then if you're a medicine resident and you need tutoring for the EBIM boards exam, or like the medicine in training exam, or you're a college student and you need tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, I offer tutoring for all those things. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I hope you find this podcast to be helpful. Thank you. God bless you.